I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea.
Thank you for joining us today for The American Idea. I'm Kara Rogers-Stevens, Associate Professor of History at Ashland University and one of your hosts for The American Idea podcast. Our topic today is one that is near and dear to my heart as an historian of the Revolutionary and founding periods. We're going to discuss the life and work of one of the very first Americans to write a history of the Revolution. Her name was Mercy Otis Warren. And if anyone should count as a founding mother, Mercy Otis Warren certainly should. Our guest for this conversation, Brenda Hefera, recently published an article about Warren for Law and Liberty. It is entitled Our Forgotten Founding Mother. Brenda is the Assistant Director and Senior Policy Analyst for the Simon Center for American Studies at the Heritage Foundation. She received her bachelor's from Villanova University, as well as a Bachelor of Science in Finance and a Master's in Political Science. So all from the same institution.
That's right.
Oh, you're a good advertisement for them. She was a Publius Fellow at the Claremont Institute and a James Madison Fellow at Hillsdale College. Her articles have appeared in publications from Modern Age to The Federalist to Law and Liberty, National Interest, Real Clear Public Affairs, and The Hill. Welcome to the show, Brenda.
Thank you for having me.
Now, first of all, many of our listeners may not be familiar with Mercy Otis Warren. Can you just introduce us to her? Who was she? Where was she from? And what is she famous for doing?
Sure. So Mercy Otis Warren, to quote John Adams, was the most accomplished lady in America, which is quite sad that we've forgotten her mostly. So she was born in 1728 in Massachusetts. So that's puts her sort of between John Adams and Benjamin Franklin. She's just a few years older than Washington. So she's of that revolutionary generation, sort of the earlier revolutionary generation. And she lives in Massachusetts, so she sees everything, right? So much of the early revolution is based in Boston, and all those things happen there. So she's there. She's an Otis and a Warren. So she's a member of two very prominent political families in Massachusetts. Her father was the representative in the Massachusetts House of Representatives. Her husband became the Speaker of that house. And then, of course, her brother, James Otis, was a very prominent lawyer in the Revolution. And he argued against the general writs of assistance, which when he argued that in court, John Adams said there and then the child liberty revolution was born, right? So she's
Yes,
she's very, very significant. She knows all these really prominent players, but she herself is a very accomplished lady. So she writes plays, first of all, which we probably wouldn't think of them as plays today. They're more in the realm of pamphlet literature. So these appear on the front pages of newspapers. They're comparatively short to what we would think, and they're really meant to drum up support for the patriot cause. She's kind of portraying and responding to some of the events that are happening in Boston, like the Boston Massacre. So she writes plays, she writes poems, which again are along the same lines of portraying those events, published in the newspapers. She writes an anonymous pamphlet on observations on the Constitution. So she's an anti-federalist. She she objects to the Constitution that for a long time was thought to be authored by Elbridge Gerry, but it's not. It's Mercy Otis Warren. And Herbert Storing says it's one of the most philosophical pieces from the anti-federalist. So it's quite significant. And then finally, her lengthiest work is The History of the American Revolution, which is very comprehensive. It's one of the first that comes out, and it's to date the only anti-federalist account of the American Revolution.
Oh, that's fascinating. So when John Adams refers to her as an accomplished woman, I always think about the argument in Pride and Prejudice between Elizabeth and Darcy and a few of the other characters about what makes a woman accomplished. So they're talking about what she can play the piano and speak French and perhaps dance in a very pretty manner. But Mercy Otis Warren, she has some serious intellectual accomplishments that John Adams was recognizing.
Right. As Darcy said, would say, she had improved her mind by extensive reading.
That's a brilliant segue. Yes. So that's, I think, one of the interesting things about Mercy Otis Warren. And maybe you can tell us a little bit about how was it that she was able to contribute so much intellectually? Where did the knowledge that she was expressing come from?
Right. So she didn't receive a formal education, right? Which was
quite common. Didn't go to college.
Right. During that time. But her brothers were being tutored by their uncle, who was a very learned man. And her father permitted Mercy, because she expressed an interest in this, to learn from her uncle as well. So Mercy is just, she doesn't learn the original language, but she is a voracious reader, right? And you can tell in the history she's quoting Xenophon and those sorts of things. So she's just, and she says in a letter to her husband, they had a really lovely relationship, and she missed him very much when he was away when serving these political appointments. And one of those letters that she said something like, in the ancients she has found most excellent company. So I think, first and foremost, she was very much a student of history, a student of the ancients. Raleigh's history is one of her favorites, but she read very widely. Pope, Shakespeare, all those folks.
My goodness. So would it be fair to say that she had a classical education and then she also furthered that education on her own? She was self-taught in some of these areas.
Yes. So she's tutored by her uncle, but she reads all her life.
Okay.
Right. I think at one point, I think it was her husband who cautions her about, you know, reading by candlelight. Don't stay up till the wee hours.
Oh, that's right. And I believe she had eye problems.
Yes, she did.
I wonder if he was concerned that the bad light was not helping as she was losing her sight. But I'm so glad that you brought up her husband and her happy marriage. What else did she have going on? Did she have a large family of her own while she was doing all of this reading and writing?
Yes. So she has five sons.
Goodness.
So, she is mostly managing the household, right?
Okay.
As she's doing these things as well. Her husband is often away during the war. And so she's left there to manage those responsibilities and obligations. And it's quite a lot, right?
Much like Abigail Adams. Wow.
Yes.
And how did Mercy Otis Warren balance those two aspects of her life? That she sounds in many ways like a modern career woman. So she's publishing these different works, she's commenting on politics, but she's also a wife and a mother with a very busy home life. Would she have thought of herself the way that maybe a modern woman thinks of herself, trying to have it all? Or would she conceive of her role perhaps in a different way?
I don't think she would think of herself in the modern way, because she doesn't. She's a political person, but I don't think she really thinks of women in politics per se. She's just personally very interested in herself, but she doesn't talk a lot about sort of what we would call feminist literature today. She really doesn't go there. She's just interested in politics. But there is a certain degree where she has phases of her life, right, where she obviously has five children. And so there's a time and period in her life where she's really devoted to that, because, of course, it's very time consuming. But then so her history, she writes later on in her life. So she goes a little bit through phases, but she's pretty consistent in some of the shorter articles. And she writes poetry a lot all her life. Some of it, of course, she doesn't publish, but she's just interested in that personally. It's who she is, right?
Wow. Yeah, that's interesting that she thought about herself as a political, what was the phrase you used? A political person, a political woman?
Yes, I think that's right. So it's, you know, Abigail Adams, of course, writes that letter to the Remember the Ladies letter to her husband.
Right. That's very famous. Yeah. Yes.
And Abigail says something. She writes to Mercy Otis Warren about this.
Right.
And how John Adams had sort of responded to her cheekily. Right. And I think Abigail's a little bit incised, and Mercy never responds. And yeah. We don't quite know why. And apparently she was not particularly a fan of Mary Wollstonecraft. So okay. I just don't think it's the thing that she's interested in, right? She's interested in small R Republican government. She's interested in ancient philosophy, those sorts of things. So she doesn't particularly write or think a great deal about women's role in society or something like that. She's just,
That's fascinating. So she's living at a time where women are not typically voting, with the exception of New Jersey for a few years after the revolution. But in other places, women would have not really questioned the fact that they did not vote. They were not directly represented in government. They were not, as we said earlier, expected to be very well educated, certainly not to go to college, certainly not to work outside of the home in most cases. And so it's tempting to look back on somebody as accomplished as Mercy Otis Warren and say, well, she must be one of the first feminists. But as you say, she wasn't writing about women and women's rights, women's equality. I'm almost tempted to say she was just living a life in which she did not limit herself because she was a woman. She just allowed herself to have opinions the same as the men in her family did about the events and the politics that were going on around her, and to contribute to the national conversation through her publications without, as you say, getting involved in maybe what Abigail Adams is able to put a little bit closer attention on when she asks her husband to remember the ladies and to make sure that the husbands do not have so much power over their wives. Mercy Otis Warren never really said anything like that, did she?
No, not really. Now, there is, of course, the fact that she lives it in a sense, right? She is a female historian, which she received criticism for. It was not known, right? It seems as if the literature, the poetry, the plays, that was more accessible for that generation, to say that women could participate in that space without as much, you know, pushback.
And she published some of that anonymously as well, didn't she? People might not even have realized she was a woman at first.
Yes, the plays are anonymous. The poetry, that compilation, she does publish under her own name. Okay, and that's very well received by folks like Alexander Hamilton.
That was acceptable.
Yes. But she does feel a little bit self-conscious about doing these things. You know, John Adams is very encouraging to her. Her husband is very encouraging of sort of a self-consciousness of a woman doing these things. And they kind of urge her on and recognize that she has this beautiful mind, right? That she should be doing these things.
And that's rather remarkable for the time, that there were so many men in her life who supported her, who encouraged her in these intellectual endeavors. In some ways, we might look back and say she was a beneficiary of these men supporting her and was able to accomplish as much as she did because she had men in her life who supported her when perhaps other women did not. But you quoted actually Alexander Hamilton in your essay, and it's a great quote. He's in this quote talking about Mercy Otis Warren, and I believe he's referring to her work of poetry. Mm-hmm. And he says, in the career of dramatic composition, at least, female genius in the United States has outstripped the male. So he's perhaps not indicating that he believes that women are uniformly the intellectual equals of men. What do you think he is willing to concede? What is he trying to say there about Mercy Otis Warren?
Right. So I think there's a question in this era of, you know, sort of, are men better at this thing or are women better at this thing? And there's a sense of perhaps, you know, there's certainly a sense of basic equality, right? Yeah. All men are created equal, which they mean mankind, of course. Right. But then there's a question of, and many people believed in terms of intelligence, intellect, those sorts of things, that men and women seem to be pretty much equal. But some people believed in separate spheres, of course. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think what he's getting at there is, you know, women weren't writing that much up until this point. There was some novels, perhaps. There's a first British historian that Mercy Otis Warren writes letters to, right? Catherine McKay. Women are just starting to come into this space. And so she's demonstrating, Mercy Otis Warren, she's one of the first, that in this area, women can hold their own, right? And I think he's recognizing that and responding to that.
That's interesting. Yeah, she really is representative of this wave of change that occurs because of the American Revolution. That prior to these events, colonial women didn't seem to really question their role in society or push for a larger role in society. And they were understood to be very useful and important individuals, equals in soul, if in nothing else, I think many religious Americans would say. But their role was to be in the home. After the American Revolution, it seems like both American women and American men began to see American women, yes, is still remaining in the domestic sphere, but also as having an important role in the Republic. And so this is referred to by a lot of historians as this concept of Republican motherhood, mm-hmm. that an American woman had an important role in perpetuating the Republic as a mother, as a wife, as an example to society through her morality in many different ways. And Mercy Otis Warren, I'll ask you a little bit more about her views on virtue and morality in a moment. But before we even get to that, we have to talk about how she was unusual because she also thought deeply about politics. And you give us a little hint about her political beliefs in one of the quotes in your essay. It's the quote where Mercy Otis Warren says, "Man is born free and possessed of certain unalienable rights, that government is instituted for the protection, safety, and happiness of the people, and not for the profit, honor, or private interest of any man, family, or class of men, that the origin of all power is in the people, and that they have an incontestable right to check the creatures of their own creation, vested with certain powers to guard the life, liberty, and property of the community." How would you characterize Warren's politics? And do you see her views as evolving drastically over time?
So she knows the arguments, right? Yeah. She is very in line with the American political thought of the founding generation. That quote that you just read is very consistent with the underlying philosophy and the deductions of the Declaration of Independence, right?
Sounds almost Jeffersonian.
Yes, it does. And this is, I mean, there was broad agreement on this, right? She's writing as an anti-federalist. And so, you know, we tend to think, well, the anti-federalists are, of course, against the federalists. And so there's this huge disagreement between the two of them. But amidst that, we can't lose sight of the broad agreement that is happening in America when it comes to things like natural law, natural rights. And so Mercy Otis Warren had read many of the philosophers that the founders relied upon, Locke, Montesquieu, these sorts of folks. So she knows these arguments and she's making them herself. She understands all of this. So broadly, she's a member of this generation. In terms of party politics, she is an anti-federalist because she thinks that the Constitution is not Republican, small or Republican enough. Right? Mm. She's concerned about the blending of powers. She's concerned about things like a standing army, that there's not a Bill of Rights. So she shares many of the more common anti-federalist concerns. And then later on, she becomes a capital R Republican in the line of Jefferson and Madison, right? She's concerned, she's on the side of the sort of sturdy virtues of the yeoman farmer, right? She wants those more simplistic habits. She wants more homogeneity, that there's a large diffusion of property and America becomes a very agrarian society. She's a bit, again, the ancient philosopher, she's a bit more inclined towards the Roman virtues, right? Mm-hmm. More kind of stoic, and she's a Puritan, so that speaks to her as well. So she becomes a supporter of Jefferson and Madison, and she's not very much a fan of Hamilton. She calls them crackpot commercial schemes of Hamilton, despite what he says about her poetry, right? She does not approve of that, and she becomes critical of Washington as well.
Oh,
and
wow.
She praises him effusively in her history, and then she thinks he's too influenced by Hamilton.
By Hamilton.
Yeah. And John Adams.
I have to agree with her about that.
Yeah. And John Adams as well. She, along with many others, she thinks he becomes too enthralled by the British Constitution and monarchy.
Before we continue with our conversation, I'd like to have one of our faculty members tell you about a special documents-based graduate program for teachers of American history, government, and civics.
Hi, this is John Moser, chair of the Master of Arts in American History and Government program at Ashland University. If you are an educator who teaches U.S. history, government, or politics, our program may be just what you've been looking for. Our approach is to emphasize primary sources, since we think the best way to study the past is to read the words of those who lived it. We have a distinguished faculty made up of professors from both Ashland University and from colleges and universities across the country. And they're not there to lecture to you. We think it's better to learn through conversation about the documents. Ours is a hybrid program with two different types of seminar. The first are our week-long intensive in-person courses during the summers on the beautiful campus of Ashland University. The second are our live synchronous online seminars offered throughout the year. So if you're a social studies teacher and you're looking to deepen your understanding of America's past and its politics, please check out the Master of Arts in American History and Government program. You can do that by visiting tah.org/programs.
See, that's very surprising to me. So you mentioned earlier that Abigail Adams was confiding in Mercy Otis Warren about her relationship with John. And in fact, the Adamses were friends with mm-hmm. the Warrens, and Mercy Otis Warren was encouraged in her writings by John Adams. You would have expected that she would be a Federalist. If not, you know, around the constitutional debates, then certainly by the time John Adams is becoming a leader of the Federalist Party, it's a little bit surprising to me that she broke ranks with these fellow New Englanders, fellow Puritans, and she becomes a supporter of Thomas Jefferson. I mean, how do we explain this this disloyalty? And was this something that John Adams took personally, or was he understanding about her her political movement away from him?
Well, I would say that it's Adams who shifts. I think Mercy Otis Warren is fairly consistent throughout her life. She does come around to the Constitution, right, in part because I think she sees it play out, right? And it's not the danger to republicanism that she thought it was going to be. So she, at the end of her history, she says this is a remarkable document, right?
Okay.
So the fight with Adams is rather interesting. So the two couples are friends, right? They're power couples, right? James Warren and Mercy Otis and Abigail and John Adams. So all of them know each other. Mercy is writing both to John and to Abigail. When wow. she would go to visit her husband during the war, she would stop at the Adams farm and visit with Abigail. And for an extended period, they actually send their oldest daughter to go and stay with Mercy Otis Warren for a while, and she tutors Abigail, Nabby. They're quite close. And Adams, of course, helps. He encourages her writing. He helps it get it placed sometimes mm-hmm. in newspapers. And it experiences a break for a couple reasons. So one of the things that Mercy does, she writes to John Adams when he's president to try and help secure a political position for her son, Winslow, who's wayward, let's say. He's her favorite, but he's troublesome. And Adams, of course, does not respond well to that. So that's part of the reason. And then there's the political side, right? They do end up disagreeing politically. And then it really comes to a peak when Mercy publishes her history, because she has some critical things to say about John Adams. She says, you know, his passion sometimes gets in the way of his judgment, those sorts of things, which a lot
totally
of people
true.
Would agree with. And he sends her, you know, just to sort of confirm her point, he sends her 10 letters and doesn't always wait for her to respond to the letters. So he just, and some of them are just over the top, right? He criticizes her. She lists the accomplishments. She lists out 3 men and how they contributed to something. And she didn't put John Adams first in that list. And so he criticizes her for doing that. So I think at this point, he's just in general frustrated with not getting what he feels like is his due and recognition for the American Revolution.
And by this point, he's lost re-election. He's no longer in political power. So perhaps he feels like this is a little bit more backstabbing from an old friend that he wouldn't have expected.
Yeah, and maybe he has a little too much time on his hands.
Yes, he certainly did do a lot of writing in his retirement years.
Yes, but fortunately they do reconcile. Elbridge Gerry kind of helps to smooth the waters. So,
my goodness. So similar to how John Adams and Thomas Jefferson didn't speak for quite some time, John Adams stopped speaking to Mercy Otis Warren for quite some time after the publication of her history.
Right.
Interesting. How was her history of the American Revolution received in general? Was it a very popular book? Did people praise her as a woman for having written such a thing? Or were there a lot of criticisms like Adams?
She did get criticized specifically for being a woman and writing a history. She was criticized a bit for the prose, which I garner is not uncommon for criticism during that time. So it wasn't as popular as some of her other works, I think, in part perhaps because it is anti-federalist. Now, I will say, I think it very much holds up in the sense of being historically accurate. It's not unbiased, but it is very historically accurate because she's in conversation and she knows all these people. Yeah. I mean, you can't get primary sources better than Mercy Otis Warren.
Right.
So she says and that she's in epistolary contact with most of the major players, and that's what she's relying on for her accounts, and she's relying on the official accounts that are published in the Boston newspapers. So in terms of accuracy, I think it measures up. It's not exactly what we would recognize today as a history. So it's a little bit like Alexis de Tocqueville's Democracy in America. It's a moral account. She has views and she provides things like character sketches and assessments of people's character. She talks about the principles and the importance of the American national character for the revolution. So it's not this sterile account. And she talks about the role of providence, those sorts of things. So she's very philosophical. It's as someone who studied American political thought, I quite enjoy that part of it.
Interesting. That's maybe a more old-fashioned way of thinking about a history, the job of a historian. Now, supposedly, modern historians are entrusted with writing these objective accounts of historical events without injecting their own personal biases or morals even into their historical accounts. Now, whether or not we're always successful at that is a completely different story, but at least in the ancient sense and perhaps the way that Warren was seeing herself, the historian's role was to draw moral conclusions and lessons and to teach her readers something through her commentary on these historical events. So that's very interesting that you draw our attention to that aspect of her work. Tell us, right. how did she conceive of civic virtue? Or did she, at the end term, how would she have thought about virtue, and how did she seek to further the virtue of the morals of her country, of this Republican experiment?
Right. So I think that ties perfectly into what you just said of what she sees herself as doing in writing this history. It's about maintaining the Republic. She says at the onset, she has a particular view to the youngest generation of Americans. That's part of why she's writing this history. And it's about preserving memory and about preserving gratitude in America. So she quotes at the end of it a rather famous quote from Xenophon about what ingratitude does to a nation and to a republic, because it breaks down all these bonds. He says something like, someone who's ungrateful can't love their parents, their gods, or their country.
Oh, wow.
So she really sees, and that's the source of kind of shamelessness, and it really is degrading. And Mercy is a student of the ancients, of course. So she quotes this, and she knows very much that a republic depends on a virtuous citizenry. She says that in the Sack of Rome and some of her other works. So she's very attentive to that. And she becomes very concerned that the manners in America are starting to rapidly degrade after the American Revolution. It seems to her that people are forgetting what they fought for and sacrificed for, and that all of a sudden they're becoming this greedy commercial society. She focuses in a lot on that, of greed, of avarice, and she sees that then degrading into ingratitude, right? Oh, so she's very much concerned with this. And she's concerned with that in her personal life as well. She writes very often to her sons to attend to their character, to attend to their virtue and manners. And she writes, there's this book that's called Lord Chesterfield's Letters that comes out, and it's very famous in high society, and it's Machiavelli in, you know, epistolary form of, it's more important for men to have the appearance of virtue than actual virtue, and they should basically seduce young women and do this. And Mercy is just appalled, right, by this and speaks out against it. So she's consistently concerned with manners and morals. And like many in the 18th century, she saw those things as ultimately connected to virtue. You know, for example, George Washington copies the 110 rules of civility. And we sort of laugh at that today and think it's a little bit frivolous. But no, most people in the 18th century thought those everyday morals, those everyday niceties formed your character.
Right.
And that was tied to morality and virtue.
And that was uniquely necessary in a republic, I imagine, because there wasn't a king binding everybody together or ordering society or enforcing rules. In a republic that was ostensibly self-governing, the citizens had to have their own inner moral compass and their own ways of binding together in unity, perhaps even through such things as George Washington's rules of civility, to create this well-functioning social unit. So that's so interesting that was something that Mercy focused in on. And I wonder, would you say that this was something that she could speak to, particularly because she was a woman and a mother? Or was this just something very typical of all writers about civic virtue at the time?
Well, you touched on the concept of the Republican mother, and other people have talked about the Republican wife as well. Mm-hmm. And so I think that concept, I think she would agree to a certain extent in that once you have a republic, the morals and the upbringing of children become incredibly important.
Yes.
Right? Because you are forming future citizens. And it's just a reality that those relationships become incredibly important, which is not to say that's the only way that women contribute politically, but it's just true. right? Of you form your husband forms you, and the two of you form your children. And forming good citizens is perhaps the most important thing for a republic, forming good character. So I think she is probably interested in that, in that way, but also just personally, it seems to be something that she cares very much about. She's an upstanding, sort of rigid lady in that respect.
Yes. In your essay, you call her a founding mother. Why should Americans care about the so-called founding mothers? And as we've noted before, they didn't have political power. They couldn't get elected. They didn't fight. What did somebody like Mercy Otis Warren actually contribute to the founding? And why should we still pay attention to her today?
Well, everything she writes is worth reading. It's very, very interesting and thoughtful. Her history is probably the most important work, but her observations on the Constitution was quite influential. She publishes it, and it gets fairly widely distributed in New York, which is going through the ratifying convention. So this is part of the conversation, right? And one of the things that she advocates for is a Bill of Rights, which of course gets added.
We get, right? Yes, okay. Right?
So it is, you know, she publishes anonymously. So she's worth reading in the sense that anyone who is thoughtful has something to teach us. She's worth reading in the same way that any of the classics are worth reading. She's very interesting and careful. And as you said, it is noteworthy to remember that after 1776, things change quite rapidly. And I think Gordon Wood writes about this so well, to remember that, yes, women, for the most part, were not voting during the founding, but you have to put that in the perspective of human history. The property rights for women were far better in America than they were in other parts of Europe. Like, America very rapidly becomes more equal. Things like primogeniture and entail laws get done away with very quickly. Thomas Jefferson stands up against those very early. And there's this another lovely example that I think is so interesting, that after 1776, family portraits, the husband traditionally was depicted as presiding over his family, as being above them.
Right.
And after 1776,
all the women are seated.
Yes, and the children. Yes. And after, he's on the same level.
Yeah.
So there's this unfolding sort of rolling changes in America that happen because of these principles. And we tend to forget that because we always kind of focus on, well, what women were not able to do during this founding. But it's quite radical what they are able to do, and it continues in that direction because of the principles of all men are created equal and because of those founding principles.
That is fascinating. They may not have immediately achieved equal political rights, but they certainly were respected as citizens. They did have the rights of citizens and these ideas of equal natural rights that we've been referring to. Plus the idea that they were playing a vital role in continuing the republic through their virtue, through their influence over their husbands and their children, and through the role that they played in a larger society. And it really is quite remarkable to think about the role that Mercy Otis Warren played and the forerunner that she was for what other women would later be able to accomplish. Now, thank you so much for being willing to come onto the program today and tell us more about this amazing founding mother. Can you tell us, what's your next article going to be about, and where can our readers find you online?
The Heritage Foundation publishes a lovely volume. It's called The Founder's Almanac, which we are reissuing and adding to this year. And I had the good fortune to write a chapter on Mercy Otis Warren. The article in Law and Liberty is a bit of a truncated version of that. So that has just been a delightful project for me. I've enjoyed reading more of her. And that will, my work is available on the Heritage website.
Okay. Thank you so much. I can't wait to read that expanded version of the almanac and your contribution to it. Fantastic. Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining me today on the American Idea podcast.
It was just a real pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.